issue of the Marshall Plan. It made Republicans more receptive to aiding Europe, but also more apprehensive about the military implications. What has happened in Czechoslovakia and Finland, Vandenberg said, makes it obvious that time is of the essence. House Speaker Joseph Martin proclaimed that the constant advance of the Iron Curtain across Europe has created a grave crisis in our international relations. The very fate of civilization is at stake. The United States had, therefore, to build up its military and naval establishments. We must make ourselves absolutely supreme in the air and under the sea. In such an environment, the Marshall Plan on its own, insisted Georgia Democrat E.E. Cox, would not pass in the House. It would have to be accompanied by military aid to vulnerable U.S. allies. The money we have sent abroad, thus far, he said, has been more than cancelled by the zeal of the communists. Libman laid out more clinically the deficiencies of the Marshall Plan that had been made apparent by the growing Soviet menace. All the calculations of the Marshall Plan are based on the assumption that France's and Britain's military effort would remain at a very low level in order not to draw off manpower, capital equipment, and imported raw materials, he wrote. If now they must arm, and that is what the Western Alliance demands, then the estimates of the plan will have to be reviewed and revised upward. Lippmann had sympathetic ears in the administration, although they did not want to raise their voice at the time for fear of jeopardizing passage of the ERP. My interest in the whole Marshall Plan was the security aspect, Harriman would reflect years later, and some of us felt that you could not have a successful economic development of Europe unless there was a sense of security, that people could not go ahead and make investments for the future without some sense of security. And indeed, France and Britain, together with the Benelux countries, set themselves on the path to rearmament through the creation of a new Western Union Defense Organization in Brussels on March 17th. But the so-called Brussels Pact was mainly backward-looking. It bound its members to collaborate in measures of mutual assistance in the event of a renewal of German aggression. The concern about Germany was real, but was beginning to fade into the distance just as Russia began looming larger. Lippmann was emphatic that the Western Union now expects and requires effective American military support as promised under the Truman Doctrine, in Lippmann's interpretation, to any nation which is threatened with Soviet domination. No longer content to call merely for U.S. air power supremacy as he had in December, he now insisted that the United States needed the power to make a tactical defense of the Western Union at the Elbe, if possible, at the Rhine at a minimum. Belgian Prime Minister Spaak echoed Lippmann, arguing that defense arrangements which did not include the United States were without practical value. For him to pretend otherwise was to deceive the Belgian people. Danish Foreign Minister Gustav Rasmussen anticipated Moscow putting the same pressure on Denmark for a non-aggression pact as it did on Finland. Such pressure might force it to seek a military alliance with Washington. But he was anxious not to have to take the step before the Marshall Plan went into effect, hoping to avoid the implication that it had military strings attached. Bevin endorsed the construction of a North Atlantic defense system to put heart into the whole of Western Europe and encourage them in their resistance to the infiltration tactics. He stressed that it would also reassure the French of their security in the event of a resurgence of the German menace. The French feared such a resurgence if a united Germany fell under Soviet domination, as Czechoslovakia had. Douglas passed on their concerns to Marshall, indicating that they were more likely to relax in their attitude regarding German industry and reconstruction, which were vital to the Marshall Plan, if assured of long-term defensive cooperation against German aggression. Bideau wrote to Marshall that Soviet methods of external pressure are similar to those used by Hitler in 1938 and 1939. Truman, he said, now had to understand the gravity and the imminence of the danger to France and Western Europe. The U.S. has shown admirably generous concern through the offer of economic aid, but the moment has now come to extend the collaboration of the old and the new world to the political and as quickly as possible to the military field. Lovett emphasized that the Marshall Plan was intended to lessen dangers and possibilities of war, and that airing the issue of a U.S. defense commitment too soon would spook Congress and jeopardize its legislative prospects. Hickerson, a tough-talking Texan who deeply distrusted the Soviets, also felt that the state of the United States' defenses severely limits its immediate military capabilities. He stressed to Marshall that the problem at present is less one of defense against overt foreign aggression than against internal fifth column aggression supported by the threat of external force on the Czech model. Secretly, however, the policy planning staff in the National Security Council began preparing for a possible U.S. military support of the Western Union, including a unilateral assurance by the United States to the nations in the Western Union that the United States will consider armed attack by the USSR or its satellites against any one of these nations to constitute armed attack against the United States. The State Department opened secret talks with the British and Canadians in Washington on March 22, examining the possibilities of a military ERP. Truman would, in April, approve private talks with congressional leaders on extending the Brussels Security Pact to North America. Thus, it seemed, the core of the Marshall Bloc was well on its way to becoming militarized, much as Stalin had always said it would. A Soviet Foreign Ministry analysis prepared for Vyshinsky and Molotov concluded that the new Western Union was the first official military-political allied agreement in the general creation of the Western Bloc, under the leadership of the USA. The agreement presents itself as a military alliance directed first and foremost against the Soviet Union and new democratic countries, and is an instrument of American expansion. In the economic sense, this agreement complies with the Marshall Plan and is part of its development. In the political sense, this agreement is leading towards the division of Europe. The American, British, and French governments would maintain that theirs was only a necessary defensive response to clear acts of Soviet aggression. But one thing was clear to both sides. It would not stop here. In the West, a full-scale transatlantic military alliance was in the making. Stalin did not want war, only the threat of it in Berlin, which he believed the Allies could not defend. On March 9, 1948, Marshal Sokolovsky and his political advisor Vladimir Semyonov were summoned to Moscow from Berlin. Foreign Ministry official Andrei Smirnov told them that Moscow now needed to disrupt Allied plans to put together a Western Bloc, including Germany. If the Allies rejected cooperation within the Council of Foreign Ministers, this would mean they had finally decided against settling the German question on the basis of the Potsdam decisions. In that case, the Soviet government would be obliged to close off completely its occupation zone, introducing the appropriate financial measures and organizing frontier defense. Shortly thereafter, Stalin began authorizing a spiral of measures designed to asphyxiate the Western powers in Berlin. Official and impromptu air, train, and auto traffic restrictions into and out of the city, begun without fanfare early in the new year, were ratcheted up. The city's Soviet-controlled press reported that subversive and terrorist elements had been exploiting lax transit controls to undermine the Eastern Zone, requiring that supplementary regulations relating to Western travel into and out of the city be brought into effect from April 1st. Within the city itself, a people's police was established, effectively giving the Communist SED Party a private militia in the east. On March 26th, SED co-chairman Wilhelm Pieck told Stalin in Moscow that he would be glad if the Western Allies left Berlin. This might be the only way for the communists to avoid defeat in the city's autumn elections. "Let's try with all our might then," Stalin responded, "and maybe we will drive them out." On April 17th, Semyonov cabled Molotov from Berlin, confirming implementation of his orders to block transport communications between Berlin and the Western occupation zones. These notably excluded air traffic, likely owing to a fatal encounter 2 weeks earlier on April 5, when a Soviet Yak fighter jet, buzzing a British civilian plane over Berlin, collided with it. Both pilots died along with two Americans and 12 other Britons. Each side blamed the other. Military air power being a Western strength, Stalin may have preferred to avoid further such incidents for the time being. "Our measures," Semyonov reported, "had already dealt a serious blow to the prestige of the Americans and British in Germany. The Soviets could therefore just let the weak Allied air bridge supplying West Berlin collapse of its own weight." Stalin knew that West Berlin was a hostage he could only kill once. Once it was dead, the rest of Allied-occupied Germany would be beyond his reach, absorbed into the new hostile Western bloc. Given that the priority was to stop the London program going forward, he would need to restrain his impulse to pull the trigger. At this stage of the Marshall Plan's development, George Kennan began to marginalize himself. He considered Lippmann's views on American obligation to protect its European allies militarily preposterous. Kennan was alarmed by moves to establish a West German state, even though he had been advocating the country's division since 1945. He opposed a Western military alliance, continuing to lay emphasis on economic recovery as the cornerstone of European security. "Give the Marshall Plan a chance," he recalled wanting to tell the Europeans. "The economic field is one in which we are strong. Let's not call attention to our military weakness by making a big splash about the military situation right now." These positions raised questions to which Kennan could never offer compelling answers. How would German recovery, which he accepted as necessary for European recovery, proceed without an end to the Soviet veto over reindustrialization and currency reform? How would France and Britain be made to abandon designs for national economic autarky without American guarantees against both German and Soviet aggression? At a minimum, it was becoming apparent that American economic diplomacy would not achieve its ends without a rupture in the Yalta-Potsdam political and security arrangement. That Kennan was now oddly positioned to the left of old sparring partners like Lippmann and Clay had one of three possible explanations. The first is that they had misunderstood him, that is, the Kennan of the long telegram and Mr. X. This was Kennan's argument now, that containment had never been about setting up military pacts and shutting down diplomacy. But this is not credible. Kennan had, in 1947, been forthright in proclaiming the need for Washington to bare its teeth and forego illusions about the utility of dialogue with Moscow. The second is that he had converted his old enemies, but that they had overshot in their converts' zeal. This position is more plausible, particularly in regards to Clay, a man who preferred to bulldoze barriers, whether they be French or Russian, than maneuver around them. The Soviets had, as Kennan had predicted, shown themselves uninterested in reasoned compromise. They were too suspicious of the West. Clay, Lippmann, and other critics of Mr. X were now adapting to the new facts on the ground. The third explanation is the most compelling, that Kennan was, in spite of his writings, never comfortable with the military as a tool of peacetime diplomacy. He reveled in highlighting logical failings in others, but recoiled at seeing his own logic acted upon. Kennan now argued that democracies were ill-suited to the use of armed forces tactically in peacetime. The effort to do so only elevated the level of belligerent feeling toward the enemy, dangerously, in order to justify itself. "It was I who pressed for containment and for aid to Europe as a form of containment," he wrote in private notes, "but I think I was wrong, not in my analysis of the Soviet position, but in my assumption that this government has the ability to operate tactically in the foreign field." The experts like himself invariably got pushed aside by the military and the politicians. This defeatism was a repudiation of his own War College lectures the previous October. It was also a staggering admission of strategic failure. It suggested that his own ideal form of containment, the Marshall Plan, could not work without a security element, and that the addition of this element would lead inevitably to war. of this self-doubting canon, Lovett would say, I like him more as Mr. X. In any case, the train had departed and could not be called back. Bolin, too, had opposed a military alliance, though later came to see it as simply a necessity. Time would tell whether Kennan's dark new fears would be justified, but his career as government sage was in its last lap. As the legislative drama of the Marshall Plan headed into its final act, the New York Times focused on the stakes for Moscow and Washington. International communism, correspondent Drew Middleton wrote, was coming off nearly 3 years of sweeping success. The Marshall Plan, however, represented the most effective political and economic opposition it has encountered since Lenin founded his communist state nearly 31 years ago. We were, therefore, entering a period of a major communist offensive to undermine it. Endorsing the administration's narrative, Middleton said that the plan struck at the root of communist influence in Western Europe, which was political chaos, economic instability, and personal insecurity and fear. Only the United States, with its unrivaled economic might, could wield such a weapon. The Cominform under Zhanov would undertake to blunt it by instigating strikes and industrial sabotage, particularly in Italy, backed up by propaganda, bribes, and threats. This is why the Marshall Plan, if it is to work in some areas, he concluded, must be bolstered by military backing. This refrain was becoming ominously familiar. The Senate floor debate from March 3rd to 13th took on this dilemma without resolution. To get the aid bill passed, Vandenberg tried to treat the Marshall Plan narrowly as a business enterprise, and to defer larger questions regarding the nature of America's political and military relationship with Europe. Others, however, attacked this approach as unworthy or even irresponsible. Minnesota Republican Joseph Ball insisted that the Russian threat was fundamentally military in character, and that an economic program was therefore inadequate on its own. A military program was necessary to checkmate the onrolling avalanche of Soviet power. Naked, completely ruthless power. Senator Lodge conceded that the Prague coup could never have been prevented through economic aid, but military support was not, he said, a practical alternative, given the strength and proximity of the Red Army. Another approach was needed to deal with the threat of subversion and internal unrest. He left unanswered, however, the question of whether a vote for the ERP implied a willingness to back it up with the threat of force. Arkansas Democrat John McClellan was unsatisfied with this ambiguity, insisting that no one should cast such a vote unless he were also prepared to support a military alliance with Western Europe. On March 8th, the Senate unanimously approved an amendment to the legislation, named for California Republican Senator William Noland, which blocked export to the Soviet Union or its satellites of all goods whose supply was inadequate to meet the demands of the ERP. A complete ban on exports of oil, machinery, and industrial goods to Russia had the support of over 70% of the public, and was opposed by only 16%. The amendment also required that at least half the aid goods be transported on American ships, to the extent that such were available. Senator Taft could once again read the tea leaves, and maneuvered to embrace the inevitable while remaining the voice of disillusioned conservatives. If I vote for this bill, he said on March 13th, just before the Senate vote, it will be with the distinct understanding that we are making a one-year commitment. If we don't want to continue this program after the first year, there is no commitment, moral, legal, or otherwise. 5 minutes past midnight on March 14th, the Senate authorized a one-year, $5.3 billion appropriation by a vote of 69 to 17. 31 Republicans voted for, Taft among them, and 13 against. Hoover also did an about-turn from his January 21st letter to Vandenberg, writing to House Speaker Martin that no reductions should be made to the appropriation. On March 17th, Truman made his final plea for speedy House ratification of ERP legislation before a joint session of Congress. The CIA having concluded that a communist victory in Italy would mean the possibility of Soviet bases in Sicily and southern Italy, that would pose a direct threat to the security of communications through the Mediterranean and have a demoralizing effect throughout Western Europe, Truman was anxious to get a final bill passed before the April 18th poll. In contrast to his Truman Doctrine address 1 year prior, the president this time had no hesitation in naming the villain of the new Cold War. Since the close of hostilities, the Soviet Union and its agents, he said, have destroyed the independence and democratic character of a whole series of nations in Eastern and Central Europe. It is this ruthless course of action, and the clear design to extend it to the remaining free nations of Europe, that have brought about the critical situation in Europe today. Although prompt passage of the European Recovery Program is the most telling contribution Congress could now make toward peace, it was no longer sufficient. So long as communism threatens the very existence of democracy, the United States had to be at a much higher state of military preparedness. He called on Congress to enact both universal military training and a restoration of selective service. The draft. With the House vote nearing, tempers flared in the chamber on March 25th. Some accused Truman of stirring up another war scare to keep himself in the White House. "It's an election year, brother," shouted Representative Claire Hoffman, Republican Missouri. Charles Vercel, Republican Illinois, insisted the money would be better spent building the strongest air force in the world. Air power would deter Stalin, whereas the Marshall Plan would merely encourage him to move his forces westward and pilfer American aid. "When he pulled the Iron Curtain over Czechoslovakia," Vercel said, "he pulled it down over $2 billion of our money and equipment. Now, if we approve the present bill, we will next be asked to arm Europe. Then will come Lend-Lease and finally the sending of millions of soldiers with full equipment to fight and die to protect the 16 nations affected by this program." The practical impact of Vercel's attack on the bill, though, like those of many of his colleagues, was modest. He was still willing to vote for $3 billion rather than $5.3 billion in immediate aid, provided there would be no further appropriations. But the latter question would, in any case, be decided by a new Congress. Rather than defeat the Marshall Plan, then, Vercel's argument fed into the growing belief that aid to Western Europe could not end with money and goods. It would have to be backed up by a credible and costly new American military investment. Indeed, Republicans insisted, over Democratic objections, to having $275 million, $2.75 billion in today's money, in military aid for Greece and Turkey written into the ERP bill, rather than considered separately as the Senate had successfully. The Marshall Plan, it now seemed clear, was to be delivered to Europe under military escort. But military measures, Reston pointed out, raised difficult wider political questions. If it were now clear that communists, once they were in government, would not hesitate to use illegal means to seize total power, as they were doing in Czechoslovakia, how was the United States to approach the elections in Italy? Could it afford not to intervene to keep the communists out of the government? If the answer were no, how could it justify supporting democracy through undemocratic means? Reston had no answers, but some in the State Department did. Steinhardt told Marshall that the lesson of Prague was that the United States needed to engage in direct internal interference in vulnerable parts of Europe, for the purpose of organizing the existing anti-communist forces effectively. He acknowledged that interference was contrary to conventional diplomacy, but we have an opponent who breaks the rules. The relationship between the Marshall Plan and democracy was muddied from the start by the inclusion of Greece, which had been the fulcrum of the Truman Doctrine. But the House weakened the link further on March 30th, just before voting on its version of the ERP bill. Supported by anti-Soviet hawks at the Defense Department, it passed a resolution endorsing Spain's inclusion. Spanish dictator Francisco Franco commended the House, calling the vote, which succeeded in spite of the attitude of its president and secretary of state, a true representation of the feelings of the American people toward his country. The House omnibus bill also contained $900 million, $9 billion in today's money, in military aid for China, Greece, and Turkey, and international emergency child relief, on top of the $5.3 billion for Europe. The State Department strongly opposed the supplemental funds, partially on the grounds that they might delay passage of an ERP bill, and partly because of diplomatic concerns. The inclusion of ERP in a bill which also dealt with military aid, Hickerson wrote to Lovett on March 8, would inevitably link ERP to potential military action against the Soviet Union or its agents. This would change the whole emphasis of ERP from a program to promote positively European recovery to a program of defense against Soviet aggression. It might, in turn, deter certain countries, notably neutral Sweden and Switzerland, from participating. In that case, we would have engineered a break in the front of non-communist European cooperation. Still, the omnibus bill passed in the House on March 31st by a vote of 329-74. 171 Republicans voted yes, 61 no. 158 Democrats voted yes, 11 no. The additional funding added by the House would make its way into the final reconciled legislation, although funding for Spain would not. Irked by communist claims that the United States was a reactionary force allied to every undemocratic government in Europe from Greece to Spain, and that the Marshall Plan was aimed at securing bases for war with the Soviet Union, the administration, with Vandenberg's support, successfully cajoled the House-Senate conference into excluding Spain. Small remaining Senate and House bill differences were quickly resolved, and on April 2nd, the Economic Cooperation Act, also known as the Foreign Assistance Act, passed by a vote of 318-75 in the House, and by voice vote in the Senate. This measure, the President said proudly upon signing the Marshall Plan into law on April 3, 1948, is America's answer to the challenge facing the free world. The United States was, he said, in all history, the first great nation to feed and support the conquered. Truman used a dozen pens to sign the bill, giving one to each of the witnesses from Congress and his administration. Marshall, at a hemispheric conference in Bogota during the ceremonies, cabled a message calling it an historic step in the foreign policy of this country. Hoffman called it probably as well-conceived a piece of legislation as was ever put on the books in the U.S. Given the enormity of the political task in both Europe and the United States of translating Marshall's Harvard speech into an actual legislated program, or even just a down payment on one, it was certainly remarkable that it had been accomplished in a mere 10 months. Search back as one may through the annals of the United States or any other power, pronounced the economist from London, there is no record of a comparable act of inspired and generous diplomacy. The Marshall Plan would, Bevin and Bideau said in a joint statement, give new courage to the free peoples of the world. Attlee called it an act of unparalleled generosity and statesmanship. With the critical Italian elections only 2 weeks away, Togliatti addressed a rally of 20,000 Italian communists denouncing the Marshall Plan and telling the gathered that the Soviets would aid their country. Boos and chants of Lunga vita agli Stati Uniti, long live the United States, drowned him out. On April 17th, with 94% of eligible voters going to the polls, Italians gave De Gasperi's coalition 48.5% of the vote and an absolute majority of seats in the Chamber of Deputies. The socialists and communists, the latter of whom had been happy to campaign on a choice of Russia versus America, saw their combined share drop from 40% in 1946 to 31%. In Paris, Bideau breathed a sigh of relief. Back in Washington, Kennan did as well. A communist victory in Italy, he said, sounding a tad like the domino theorists he disparaged, would have undermined our whole position in the Mediterranean, and possibly in Western Europe as well. The result had been a clear demonstration of the Marshall Plan's powerful psychological effect, psychology being the element in which he had always lodged the better part of his confidence. The United States had accomplished 4/5 of the effect it was after, Kennan later reflected, before the first supplies arrived in Europe. It is notable, however, that Kennan was not content to let the Marshall Plan speak for itself. He saw it much as a coach might see an athlete whose odds of victory could and should be boosted with banned substances. In the case of the Italian elections, that substance was the CIA's first major covert operation. Though its contents are largely unknown, it certainly included a well-funded propaganda blitz to buoy the Christian Democrats and discredit the communists. Kennan considered it an enormous success, so much so that he now wanted a sustained and systematic covert effort to complement the Marshall Program. "Political warfare," Kennan would write in May, "is the logical application of Clausewitz's doctrine in time of peace." More importantly, the Soviets were doing it at a much higher level. Propaganda, support of friendly foreign elements, legal or otherwise, and clandestine operations were no different from economic aid. They all now had to be part of the American diplomatic toolkit. Vandenberg had paid a high political price for pushing a historic foreign aid package through Congress, forfeiting any chance of winning the Republican nomination. In return, he expected that his man would run the program through the new Economic Cooperation Administration. Clayton and Acheson, the president's men, would not do. At Acheson's urging, Truman accepted Vandenberg's choice, Paul Hoffman. Like Clayton, the affable, energetic 57-year-old Hoffman had impeccable industry credentials, as well as firm backing from business leaders. Like Clayton, he also believed that the real objective of the Marshall Plan was to stop the spread of communism. Unlike Clayton, Hoffman was a Republican. The only hiccup was that Hoffman did not want the job. Truman, however, would not take no for an answer, nor even maybe. Before Hoffman could confer with his wife and colleagues at Studebaker, Truman announced that he had accepted the post. Hoffman was stunned, but later professed admiration for Truman's method, which he himself had used in the business world. Hoffman was sworn in on April 9th. He started his new job, paying $20,000 a year, an 80% salary cut, immediately announcing the first expenditures that day. He quickly became, in life's words, the busiest man in Washington, fielding 10,000 job applications on his first day, before he had been given an office. Harriman Committee economist Richard Bissell became his first hire, taking the title Assistant Deputy Administrator, and would become the main architect of the structure for directing Marshall Aid. Shortly after, Hoffman appointed Harriman himself to run the new office of the Special Representative, OSR, in Paris, the Marshall Plan's headquarters in Europe. Hoffman politely rebuffed the president's recommendations for ECA appointments, insisting there could be no whiff of politics in the staffing. Truman earned Hoffman's enduring regard for respecting the edict. British Treasury official Sir Richard Otto Clark would call Hoffman's staffing of the program a most elevating spectacle. Hoffman was equally adamant that funds would be distributed in strict conformity with the law and the aims of the ERP. Some American companies, he would tell his new staff, had come to consider the ERP a bonanza in which everyone can share as an exporter who has anything to sell. But it needed to be understood that the full recovery program actually contemplates a lower rate of exports from this country. This aim contrasted with Soviet caricatures of the program's purpose. The first Marshall ships, each loaded with thousands of tons of food, fuel, chemicals, equipment, vehicles, and the like, set sail for the 16 Marshall Plan countries on April 20th. There would soon be 150 crossing the Atlantic at any given time. The first to arrive in France, in Bordeaux's harbor, bedecked in stars and stripes on May 10th, was greeted with cheers from the dockers and a welcome speech by Ambassador Caffery. Monet was elated, writing to Schumann that economic recovery was now finally possible in France, thanks to the Marshall credits. U.S. and French officials were relieved that the communists had left the ceremonies and unloading unmolested, but they were not silent. They blasted Harriman and his incoming horde of Marshall administrators as the new occupying power and la cinquième colonne américaine en France. In Italy, Togliatti pledged that the country's 2.5 million communists would wage an all-out fight against the ERP. "The sun rises in the east," proclaimed a banner at a communist rally in Vienna, "and no Marshall Plan can change or stay it." The Soviets and their communist allies in Europe condemned the plan as an instrument of preparation for war. Truman told the Canadian Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, that the situation was now as serious as in 1939. 11. Showdown. George Kennan was worried, still believing in the Marshall Plan, still believing that containment was working. He was convinced Washington was overreacting to Soviet provocations. The Czech coup had been predictable. Indeed, Kennan had predicted it. So the surge of support it unleashed for a Western defense pact was, he felt, setting the stage for a dangerous escalation of tensions. In a policy planning staff paper written during the coup, he suggested that the success of the Marshall Plan might even help bring the Soviets to the table. Shortly after, he gave an off-the-record press briefing in which he opined that a spectacular retreat of Soviet and communist influence in Europe may be expected within 6 months. Determined to help it along, Kennan advised a quiet démarche to Moscow in March. Truman approved it late the following month, and Marshall instructed Ambassador Smith in Moscow to approach Molotov with a carefully drafted oral statement. After warning Molotov at length that Moscow would be making a tragic error in assuming Washington would not defend its interests, Smith was to tell him that the door was nonetheless always wide open for full discussion and the composing of our differences. Molotov agreed to receive the old spy, as he called the general. Armed with intercepts of French cables from Berlin to Paris, he was aware of Franco-American tensions over the pace of West German unification and suspension of reparations to Moscow. The meeting was thus a golden opportunity to rupture Allied solidarity. Molotov greeted Smith on May 4, 1948, in a manner the latter described as grave, attentive, and courteous. Chief of staff to Eisenhower during the war, Smith was able, orderly, candid, straight-talking, all business. He had a harsh, powerful voice, intimidated subordinates, and made little effort to personate a diplomat. Upon learning that Smith would be sent to Moscow in the spring of 1946, Eisenhower remarked that it would serve those bastards right. Script in hand, Smith assured Molotov that America's entire history was a refutation of any suspicion of a policy which involved aggressive war. But he stressed his country's concern over Soviet behavior in Czechoslovakia. The Czech government had accepted the ERP conference invitation and withdrew it immediately following the visit of Masaryk and Gottwald to Moscow. The United States, he said, did not oppose communism because of its Marxian ideology, but purely and simply because we had seen repeated instances, as in Prague, of communist minorities coming into power by illegal means and against the will of the majority. The U.S. remained convinced that these minority coups d'état would have been quite impossible without the moral and physical support of the USSR. "No one," Molotov responded in a May 9th follow-on meeting, "had been able to find any facts to prove these false allegations. Nor can anyone state with authority that the communists have used illegal means. The fault lay instead," he said, "with rightist circles that wish to induce changes by violence. As for the United States, it was well known that the Western European and American press were saying openly that the military alliance and bases it was establishing were directed against the USSR, and events in Greece are not the only example of its interference in the internal affairs of other states." The two agreed on nothing, though Smith fulfilled his mission by transmitting the open-door message. Molotov ran the text up to Stalin, who read that part with delight, scribbling, "Ha ha," in the margins. Here, he saw, was a chance to undermine Truman with American allies and voters. Kennan had been wrong. Spectacular retreat was not on Stalin's agenda. Though Molotov had agreed that the talk with Smith would be private, TASS published the Soviet version of it on May 10th. The State Department was caught unprepared. Stalin, it concluded, was trying to create the impression that the U.S. had been forced to appeal to the USSR for a settlement. This, he hoped, would undercut U.S. leadership by sowing distrust among our friends who were not consulted in advance. Indeed, 2 days later, an angry Bevin was, thanks to the TASS release, himself subjected to angry questioning in Parliament over what he had known and when he had known it. But Stalin wasn't finished. "We do not conduct any Cold War," he wrote in a rare note to himself that month. "The Cold War is being waged by the USA and its allies." On the propaganda front, he was fighting back. Stalin had an accomplice in the U.S. presidential race. According to Gromyko's memos to Stalin from Washington, Henry Wallace began telling him of his plans to travel to Moscow sometime before April, using Czechoslovak UN Ambassador Vladimir Hudek as a secret intermediary. Meeting face-to-face on April 2nd, Wallace and Gromyko first discussed Stalin's questions about prospective U.S. presidential candidates, including Wallace himself, who would shortly be chosen by the Progressive Party and endorsed by the Communist Party. They then turned to Wallace's agenda. Wallace wanted a statement on the major questions of Soviet-American relations to be delivered by Generalissimo Stalin or by Wallace in agreement with Stalin. It should emphasize, similarly to Smith's later message, that in relations between the USSR and USA, there are no differences that could not be resolved peacefully. Such a statement, Wallace said, would be important from the perspective of influencing general opinion in the USA. He stressed that the information spread about Czechoslovakia in Washington is a lie, but that there was a necessity of undertaking something from Moscow's end with the aim of convincing the American public. Stalin was intrigued. "Though a trip by Wallace would do harm," he scribbled in the margins of the transcript, "a statement would be helpful. As for delivery, it would be better if it's done by Wallace," Stalin wrote, with Stalin stating he's in solidarity. On April 27th, Gromyko cabled Molotov that he had received through Hudek a draft of Wallace's proposed open letter to Premier Stalin. Stalin reviewed it line by line, scribbling "yes" next to the material he agreed with and edits elsewhere. Headlining a campaign rally before 19,000 at Madison Square Garden on May 11th, the day after the TASS publication of the Smith-Molotov dialogue, Wallace read out the letter, complete with Stalin's edits, disparaging Smith's message for demonstrating the same self-righteousness which has led to internal crisis. He declared that the open-door part nonetheless vindicated his long-standing claim that peace was in reach. To bring it about, however, Washington needed to change its policies. He called for the Marshall Plan to be converted into a UN effort to create an economically unified Europe, as opposed to the divided one Truman was creating. He further called for the reestablishment of a peace-loving German government in charge of a united Germany, which is obligated to the strict fulfillment of the Yalta and Potsdam agreements. This was a swipe at American actions in Western Germany. On May 17th, Moscow radio broadcast Stalin's effusive reply. The New York Times published the translation. Wallace's important document, Stalin declared, had rectified the inadequacy of the statement of the United States government of May 4th, the Smith message, by providing a concrete program for peaceful settlement of the differences between the USSR and the United States. Stalin's duplicity blindsided the State Department yet again. The distorted publication of the Smith-Molotov exchange, U.S. Chargé Elbridge Dubrow cabled Marshall from Moscow, successfully confused Europe. Now Stalin's open letter is primarily designed to confuse America, lend the appearance of substance to the vacuity of Wallace's declarations on foreign affairs, and thus emasculate American policy. Kennan would later tell Smith that the department unwittingly ran head-on into a neat little arrangement between the Kremlin and some of the people in the Wallace headquarters. Wallace, however, kept his Hudek-Gromyko channel to Stalin a secret, shielding himself from allegations that he was operating as a Soviet agent. Kennan was horrified by the ease with which the press was taken in by the Russian maneuver. He was also distraught that there had been something so seriously wrong with my analysis. When he made the prediction that communism would stage a spectacular retreat, he had failed to foresee how the political tectonics would be shifting in Stalin's favor. In Greece, communists assassinated Justice Minister Christos Ladas on May 1st. The panicked government declared martial law. In China, Mao's communists were gaining ground on Shang's nationalists, and in West Berlin, the Soviets were tightening their chokehold. Soon enough, Stalin reasoned, the Allies would abandon the city or their planned West German state. Though Stalin and Molotov were trying negotiators, the Americans would repeatedly mistake their temperaments and tactics for genuine barriers to resolving the standoff in Germany. The problem was not personalities, but the untenable foundation of the Yalta-Potsdam Accords, the idea that the other's understanding of joint power in Germany could be changed through persuasion, coercion, or new circumstances. This foundation was now in rubble, owing to the urgency of dealing with the German economy, and at the heart of the conflict over how it should operate was the institution of money. In the capitalist West, money and banking allowed autonomous individuals to make informed decisions on working, saving, investing, and exchanging. In the communist East, they allowed the state to direct resources without interference. After 1945, the Soviet Union used state direction of money and banks to eliminate private enterprise, stop unwanted spending, and prevent foreign trade from disrupting domestic economic plans through inconvertible currencies. In Berlin now, there was no form of currency or banking regime that would accommodate Western-style free enterprise without disrupting Soviet control of the city's economy and that of the Eastern Zone more widely. Soviet transportation blockages and currency demands were, therefore, two sides of the same coin. Free Allied movement into and out of the city, together with central bank co-powers, meant uncontrolled commerce and, therefore, an uncontrolled communist polity. This was not only unacceptable, but a contradiction in terms. The issue of Germany's post-war currency had emerged as a source of contention as early as 1944, when FDR's Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, unwittingly as to the lengths his deputy would go to support Soviet economic interests, put Harry Dexter White in charge of organizing the German occupation notes. In overruling the director of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, Alvin Hall, who opposed Soviet demands for copies of the American currency plates, White lied in claiming that the combined chiefs of staff had directed that such copies be handed over. The Soviets, who he said had to be trusted, went on to print up over 78 billion occupation marks, eight times what the Americans did. Notably, the mass of marks injected by the Soviets was almost identical to the number of Reichsmarks put into circulation by the Nazis, while the smaller number of American marks was consistent with the estimates of the number of Reichsmarks that would have kept prices stable. The Truman administration halted White's generosity in July 1945, making the Soviet marks, fortunately distinguishable by a dash in the serial number, invalid in Western Germany. The Soviets, who knew the marks were worthless, denied their soldiers the possibility to convert them to rubles. Red Army troops, therefore, bought what they could with them from American GIs, typically paying on the order of 10,000 marks for a $4 watch. The lucky watch seller would then convert the marks to dollars with the U.S. Treasury at the official rate, established by White, of 10-1, thereby netting himself a handsome $996 profit. The total cost to the American taxpayer in current dollar terms was as high as $6.75 billion. In 1946, Clay's currency experts called for the creation of a new Western mark, the Deutschmark, to replace the old one. A new currency would achieve maximum psychological effect. Clay proposed to the Allied Control Council that the notes be printed up under quadripartite control in the American sector of Berlin, and subsequently issued by a new central bank. The Soviets, who wanted the ability to print and issue notes at will to cover occupation costs, proposed a two-plant solution, with one in Leipzig, in their zone, that would allow them to evade Western oversight. Wrangling between the two sides went on into 1948. Each suspected the other's intentions for a shared arrangement, and each worried about the cross-zonal impact of the other issuing its own notes. But by March 1948, separate Germanies seemed unavoidable in Washington. West German inflation was running at roughly 10% a month. At the official exchange rate, a carton of American cigarettes cost about $2,000 and would rise to $2,300 by June. Royall thought the administration had been patient enough waiting for Soviet cooperation on reform. The time had come to act. "We have tried to maintain an open door to the Soviets in all our actions in Germany," he wrote to Stimson, "but we cannot permit continued stagnation in that country and still hope to revive Western Europe's economy in keeping with the objective of the ERP. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Frank Wisner wrote to Lovett on March 10th, advising that Clay be told that quadripartite currency reform was no longer a U.S. policy objective. This was, he acknowledged, a definite move toward recognition of the East-West partition of Germany. Accepting the Army's verdict that the currency stalemate was playing into Soviet hands, Lovett directed Clay to engineer a breakoff in talks. Sokolovsky obliged on March 20th, storming out of a meeting in choreographed pique. This served both sides' purposes. Sokolovsky issued new orders strengthening control on the external borders of Greater Berlin, and states stepped up transition to the Deutschmark. On May 18th, the Soviet government approved a plan to counteract Western currency reform. In the event the Allies went ahead, the Soviet military administration would have its own East German currency at the ready, and would allow circulation in the entire area of Greater Berlin exclusively to the new banknotes of the Soviet occupation zone. Facing Soviet pressure, Washington struggled to keep its coalition together. Bideau and his prime minister, Schuman, had to maneuver the London Accord through the French Assembly, roughly half of whose members, mainly Gaullists and communists, opposed an independent West Germany or even a West German currency. Knowing, as Clay put it, that the French have no air transport worthy of the name, the Russians ratcheted up road, bridge, and railway blockages with an eye to boosting the no vote on June 16th. French non-acceptance, Clay worried, will be interpreted as unwillingness to face the USSR. It was, in the end, a close-run affair. But with the socialists coming on board at the last moment, the vote was 297 to 289 in favor of the London Accord, and 300 to 286 for the Deutschmark. Allied unity had held, for now. On June 26th, Hilde Spiel, the Vienna-born writer who had settled in London before the war, talked her way onto an American military aircraft from Frankfurt to Berlin. Warned of the risk of hostile Soviet air maneuvers, she was ordered to don a parachute. The plane shook violently as it entered the narrow, turbulent corridor permitted by the Soviets. Disembarking unsteadily, after vomiting, she found a city in a state of high tension. Berliners out scavenging for food returned to crumbling homes with no electricity, the main source having been cut off in the east. The drone of Allied supply planes overhead was relentless. The roars frightened Spiel, reminding her of the Blitz. But, strangely, the enemy was still invisible. At the theater, Russians greeted her as before. She didn't know what to make of it. A currency war had just broken out, but the effects had yet to sink in. A week earlier, on June 18th, Clay, with Robertson and Koenig, the British and French military governors, had given Sokolovsky a mere few hours' notice before publicly declaring the currency changeover in the west of the country, though not Berlin, which would take place on Sunday the 20th. The angry Russian general called the move illegal and promised actions to protect the economy of the Soviet zone. On June 19th, the Soviets announced that banknotes issued in the Western occupation zones will not be allowed to circulate in the Soviet zone or in Greater Berlin, which is situated in the Soviet zone and is economically a part thereof. Fearing disorder in the Eastern zone, which would be flooded with old Reichsmarks declared worthless in the West, Moscow also blocked all interzonal passenger traffic and incoming road traffic while instituting an inspection regime for inbound trains. Use of the Deutschmark in the East was banned. Refusing to acknowledge the legitimacy of the transport restrictions, Clay, after warning Soviet officials, sent in a train to challenge them. Following a 36-hour standoff, its crew was overpowered and a Soviet locomotive hauled it back to Helmstedt on the western frontier. Unable to provision his garrison by ground, Clay began ferrying in supplies by air. As tensions climbed, currency experts from each side argued bitterly over solutions for Berlin. On June 22nd, the Americans offered a proposal for a new Berlin currency under four-power administration. The Soviets rejected it. The British offered a compromise, with the Allies accepting the Soviet mark but placing it under four-power control. Western access rights would be restored. The Soviets, however, spurned all notions of combined control or guaranteed access rights. "We give notice to you and to the German population of Berlin," they told the Allies, "that we shall apply sanctions that will ensure that only one currency will circulate in Berlin as of June 26th, the currency of the Soviet zone." This, Clay concluded, would have placed Berlin financially completely in Soviet hands. The Allied governors declared the Soviet decree invalid in the west of the city and threatened to introduce the Deutschmark in their sectors if the Soviets went ahead. The local Berlin city government, the Magistrat, which functioned with limited authority allowed it by the ACC, now found itself in an impossible political situation. Whose orders would it obey? After emotional debate, it ruled that the Soviet order did not apply outside the Soviet sector, but the elected city council had the final word. On June 23rd, the Soviets shuttled in hundreds of SED demonstrators in army trucks hours in advance of its 4 p.m. meeting. With raucous commotion in the hall delaying the start for several hours, the members voted to back the Magistrat. As legislators exited the building into the throngs of protesters, Soviet sector police helped them identify those who had voted with the West. Many were severely beaten. The same day, the Soviets announced the introduction of their own East Mark into Berlin and Eastern Germany, effective June 24th. Gum stamps were attached to old Reichsmarks bills until new bills were ready. On the 24th, Allied officers declared the Soviet initiative null and void in West Berlin and introduced the Deutschmark into the city. To keep room for compromise, though, the bills were stamped with a B to distinguish them from non-Berlin Deutschmarks. This would facilitate withdrawal at a later date. Sokolovsky announced that the Allied military government had ceased to exist and began isolating the three western sectors with a full-scale blockade. He suspended all road, rail, and barge traffic to and from the sectors owing to unspecified technical difficulties. He cut off electricity and food supplies from the east because of coal shortages and the need to prevent Western currency from circulating illegally. He moved eight Soviet combat divisions into assembly points near the interzonal border. Reports emerged of Russian barrage balloons being placed near Tempelhof airfield in the American sector to disrupt landings. The French had once again been dragged along against their will. Berlin Commandant General Jean Ganneval warned Clay of incalculable consequences which will undoubtedly not be confined to Berlin. Bideau thought the Western powers would find it very difficult to stay there for more than a few weeks unless there were a radical change in relations with the Soviet authorities. Those authorities were in turn receiving reports from their leading comrades in Eastern Germany, indicating that the Western powers would soon be forced to surrender their positions in Berlin to the Soviet Union. Clay remained defiant. By the end of June, 480 relief flights were landing each day, one plane every 3 minutes. "I may be the craziest man in the world," he told Berlin's SPD leader Ernst Reuter, "but I'm going to try the experiment of feeding this city by air." A black market money exchange sprang up near West Berlin's Zoo train station by the Tiergarten. Eastmarks, which circulated freely in the West, traded 4 or 5 to 1 against Westmarks, which were banned in the East. Newspapers sold in Eastmarks, though their printing was paid for in Westmarks. Sugar sold in Eastmarks, raisins in Westmarks. Potatoes were priceless, having not been seen in weeks. Still, most Berliners, 84% in one poll believed the Allies would sustain the city with adequate food. When the Soviets offered to feed West Berliners who registered in the East, a mere 2,000